Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
We'll cover that off as we go. Yeah. That's great. So here we are, Thrive Deeper, episode 138, Matt.
All right, and we are jumping over to the New Testament, Stu.
Absolutely.
I'm actually really excited at this point to dive into the book of Romans.
Yeah.
This is a book. Interesting responses that I have to this book from people.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people that hate it.
Yeah, yeah.
Really don't like that actually don't like the letters of Paul, but Romans particularly, there's a lot of complexity to this letter.
Yep.
People read it, what is going on here? And so it's not a popular one, I have to say.
No, well, it does my head in sometimes too. Mm. I've found myself through the years, kind of as I've read this book, having to go back and hang on, read that again. What does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, it just seems so confusing at times. Yeah. But before we jump in, let's just give a bit of context to the book of Romans. So this was written by Paul. It's a letter to the church in Rome. Probably written around 20 or 25 years after Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus. He's never been to Rome, so he's writing to a church that he hasn't actually visited. So probably a reason why he's gone into so much detail from beginning to end, rather than just because he's not had the opportunity to speak into that. In fact, also the last letter he wrote before out of prison, every other letter he wrote subsequent to this was written from within prison.
Yeah,
so,
that's right. Yeah.
You know, interesting. The other context around this is to remember also that about 5 years before this letter was written, probably Claudius, who was the emperor of Rome at the time, expelled the Jews. And so the church would have become very strongly growing from the Gentile population.
Yeah, that's right.
And then, of course, when they were allowed back in, the Jews are coming back in and going, probably going, hang on, what's going on here? You guys have got this all wrong. We're the Jews. You know, you're the Gentiles. So I probably some of that context is feeding into this as well, Matt.
It really does feed into this letter. And you're right that because he hasn't been, and this is what I think is so valuable about this letter. This is why it's so important for us to cover this and really get our heads around this, because he builds from the foundations. I mean, it's a really interesting situation. You've got Jews and Gentiles. You've got that context. The Jews have come back to now a largely Gentile church. They're thinking, hang on a minute, this is our gig. This is our Messiah.
This is our
God. Guys suddenly taking over what's going on here.
You're changing the rules.
That's right. Yeah. It's a really interesting context that actually brings Paul to explain the Christian faith. Essentially, is explaining the Christian faith from the ground up. This is so valuable that we have this letter. I know there are complexities to that. And look, the point is that we'll work through complexities. But why would we bother? We would bother because if you can understand this book, you understand your faith.
Yes.
So be bothered.
Yes, exactly.
Be bothered because it's just so crucial, this book. And I know there's a fair bit of theological depth here, but I think it's just so important for us.
Yeah, and I think it's also about digging into some of those words that we hear all the time, perhaps in our Christian faith, but we don't really fully, like the righteousness of God. Well, what is the righteousness of God? Because that then helps bring context to that particular aspect of what you're reading. So, it's great.
The interesting thing, just picking up on that issue of the expulsion under Claudius, and this is probably, a smaller expulsion around probably 41 and then another bigger expulsion later in the 40s AD.
Okay.
Maybe around 48, possibly, it's been suggested. But it was actually, according to the Roman historian Suetonius, the expulsion actually was because it says, he talks about it being some around issues to do with some figure called Crestus.
Oh, yes,
and,
correct.
And that's probably a slightly garbled Greek version of Christos, of course. Most scholars agree that that's what he's talking about.
Yeah.
So what's probably happened is that there would have been most probably Jewish Roman Jews present on the day of Pentecost.
Yes.
Who took
the message back.
Took the message back. Yeah. Received the Spirit, took the message back, would have been there to
benefit from the
churches at its inception, heard the teaching of the apostles, taken that back to Rome. So they've planted what would have been initially a sort of Jewish messianic movement in Rome that then has drawn Gentiles. Now, because of the presence of this new messianic Jewish movement, that would have stirred up quite a few issues, as it inevitably did. And then so that's what's happened. So in the 40s, because of these riots to do with, as Suetonius points out, Claudius says, well, we're just going to get rid of all of the Jews.
Yeah.
So what you have remaining is these Gentile
Christians,
the Gentile part of the church. They keep going. They seem to be going strong, because when Paul writes, and he's probably writing around 57, most probably, about 57 AD, the Gentile, it's a church go, it is a church going really strong. Now, they're not without issues, and just trying to get their heads around Jew and Gentile and how do they relate, and where does all this fit into God's purpose?
Yeah.
That's what's then wonderful about this letter, because Paul talks about God's purpose big picture.
Yes.
But then he talks about the gospel in some detail within that. So
yeah, and I don't think it was blind to Paul that Rome was the most influential city
at
the time.
Yeah.
And so he knew this church
really
had the potential to take the mission
way
beyond. I mean, his goal was to get to Spain. We don't know if he ever really got there. Some people suggest that that was probably James. But, you know, it wasn't blind to him that Rome was going to be a centre.
Yeah, that's right.
Or was the centre, and if he could really strengthen the church there. So.
Yeah.
Let's jump in, Matt.
Yeah, absolutely. So Paul does, you know, he does the usual greeting. There's a lot of theological content in the greeting. And look, we won't go into too much detail there. But there's an interesting comment, Stu, in verse 5, where it talks about, through him, through Jesus, we receive grace and apostleship to call all the Gentiles to the obedience that comes from faith for his name's sake. Now, this is an important comment. The obedience that comes from faith, this is what they're called to. Now, the big thing in this letter is going to be, how are we made right with God? I mean, talk about a fundamental question. And Paul is going to emphasize faith, right? Faith, faith, faith. Now, often what can happen is that we can read Paul as sort of pitting obedience of faith in us. Is it either obedience or is it faith? Like, what is God looking for here? But here he talks about the obedience that comes from faith. So there's a certain kind of life that that we're being called into here, and it's a life of faith that essentially is a life that fulfills the law. It's a life in the Spirit that essentially fulfills the law. Now, we'll talk about some of the issues here, but to flag the issues behind this letter, but to flag a biggie up front, there was this belief fairly common amongst Jewish people, and this is kind of behind what he's going to talk about, and we're going to look at the first three chapters today. A lot of Jews felt that their status, they're being included in God's people, you know, that for them, you know, sort of equals salvation. You know, salvation means inclusion in the people of God. And of course, beyond that, it means that you are made right with God, and there are eternal consequences to that. So for a Jewish person, they understood that we are right with God. We are saved because God has elected the Jewish people.
He's chosen us.
He's chosen. We are the chosen people.
Yes.
That's sealed in circumcision.
Yes.
And for them, if to be part of, to be a Jewish person in that sense, and to at least, you know, to have the, at least the intention to keep the law, that was enough for them.
Right.
It's like, of course we're saved because we have been elected by God.
Yes.
And that's, you know, we've sealed through circumcision. And, you know, we love the law. You know, we have the law. We love the law. We have the intention of keeping the law. So we're saved.
We're good. Yep.
Yeah, we're good.
Yep.
Now, Paul's going to say, actually, you're not so good. I mean, this is one of the problems here. That's actually not how you're saved. In fact, it was never how you were to be saved. He's going to point out it was always faith. It was always by faith. But we'll see how much that's going to play in. So I'll refer to that yeah, background belief is going to help make sense of a lot of things that Paul says. So he announces in verse 16 his topic. Okay, he's going to talk about the gospel, the good news. Mm. And he says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it's the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes, first to the Jew, then to the Gentile. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. So he's introduced, that's quite a dense comment.
Yes.
But he's introducing his topic there. He's saying this, if we get this, this is powerful stuff, okay? Mm. Mm. This good news. And the good news has something to do with the righteousness of God. Okay, so what does he mean by that? He means the righteousness of God is the way in which God, the way in which God makes things right. God is the one who makes things right.
Right.
Important point. If something is wrong with us, who's going to make it right? Well, ultimately, God is the one who's going to make that right. Mm. That's God's part. Our part is faith.
Yes.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about what that means. So Paul's talking about the good news about the righteousness of God. God has done something and is doing something to make things right.
And does that also speak to God's faithfulness to his promises?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So a big part of that, God making things right, it's not just out of the blue, God just decided. No, it's actually God is righteous in the sense that he is keeping his promises. He's announced a purpose. Mm. And he's going to do what he said. That's a big for Jewish people. That's a big, big deal. Mm. Is God going to do what he said he would do? God said that all the nations, he would draw all the nations into one kingdom. Mm. is God going to bring his Messiah and do that? Paul's answer is yes, he is. But let's understand that.
That's great.
So. It's interesting, having announced the good news, that he's going to talk about the good news.
he then draws the comparison.
He then says in verse 18 of Romans chapter 1, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people. So he's going to, in a sense, this is the backdrop against which the good news makes sense.
Yes.
Okay, if there's good news, if there's a solution, well, what's the problem? And so Paul says we all, and this is interesting because this is the thing that unites them. See, you've got two different groups of people.
Yep.
You've got the Jewish people and how do we relate to one another and do we have the same status in God's sight? You know, some of the Jewish people are saying, no, we don't actually have the same status. And so Paul is going to state the fundamental equality of all people before God, not by saying that we're all as good as each other, but by saying we're essentially all as bad as each other.
Exactly.
So he's going to put us all in the same boat.
Yeah.
That's, you know, and this is an interesting, because unity in this church is the big, is really the big deal here.
Yeah.
And we see this actually when we get to chapter 13 and 14, there's been a lot of disunity, you know, groups in this church. Paul's plan, I know how to unite you. I'm going to unite you in humility.
Yes.
I'm going to unite you by pointing out that you are all in the same corrupt boat.
Yes.
All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, as he says a little further on.
Mm.
Now, when he says the wrath of God, this is quite a disturbing statement for a lot of people because we think of an angry God who is just waiting for a chance to punish people. Now, actually, when you have a look at this chapter, that is actually not the picture that you get. Because as we have a look at this, it says the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven. How is the wrath of God being revealed from heaven? Well, what he goes on to say, he goes on to talk about God giving people over
to their desires.
To their desires, right?
Yep.
So it's in, and the question is, that's how the wrath of God is being revealed.
Yes.
And I'm going to talk about the wrath of God in a moment. This is how the wrath of God is being revealed, in that God is just letting people go the wrong way.
Wow. If that's what you want,
That's right. Now, the question is, why is God doing that?
Mm-hmm.
Is he doing that because he's abandoned the human being? No, he's not, actually. This is about allowing the fullness of the problem to come to the surface so that people will realize how much they need salvation.
Yeah.
So God is giving them over, not in order to abandon humanity, but essentially to awaken them to their plight.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So going back to the wrath of God is being revealed. This is a grief of God. Think about this in the light of the love of God. God is love.
Mm.
Now, because God is love, he is grieved when we hurt each other and ourselves.
Yes.
And so you've got to understand this, not just as a, because we tend to view God in very human terms as sort of the angry tyrant who's not getting his way and I just can't wait to punish you. I'm going to get, you know, sort of vindictive kind of tyrant view, which is a very unfortunate. There's nothing of that here.
Mm-hmm.
This is God deeply grieved at our situation.
Much like a parent would be to
that's
a child.
That's right. You know? So grieved, in fact,
yes.
that he is going to pay the ultimate price in Jesus Christ
mm-hmm.
to
make a path back.
To make a path, to actually deal with the thing that mm-hmm. he's so grieved by.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So think of this. This is a righteous anger. We would not call a judge a good judge if they were not in some sense disturbed by evil or if they were not in some sense indignant
yes.
about evil deeds. That it's perfectly fitting that a just and loving God would be angry, and I'm going to say in the positive sense, when we hurt ourselves and each other. I do as a parent, and how much more would God? So we've got to understand that in terms of God's love. Now, because of that, and again, the in a sense, the fulfillment of that wrath, of that grief of God, is not just to punish everyone. No, it's actually to save people.
Yeah,
he's going to make a way so that everyone can be made right. So the big theme through, and I'm going to do big picture.
Yeah.
Here, Stu.
Yep.
Big theme of this chapter. Is that God gives people over in order to awaken them, essentially,
mm-hmm.
so that they will realize how bad things are. Now, it's interesting to note here that it's not the moral failure that he focuses on; it's the spiritual
That's right.
issue, isn't it?
Yep.
It's idolatry. It's, as he says, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness.
Yep.
Since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made so that people are without excuse.
Yep.
So this is putting everyone in the same in the same basket. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God, nor gave thanks to him. That's actually the key issue. The key issue is that there is an idolatry issue. So they've exchanged, and the statement, you get that word used a few times here in
yes.
this chapter. Yep. They exchanged this for that, right?
Yes.
And it all comes from the fact that they exchanged the truth about God for a lie.
Yes.
They exchanged God, they turn away from God, and they turn to idols.
Mm.
And because of that exchange, everything got flipped the wrong way in every other respect. And as an example of this, and essentially what this is saying is that God gives them over to that exchange. Okay, fine. You want to serve, you want to go that way. Okay, I'll let you sort of feel the sting of that in a sense. Feel the emptiness of that, feel whatever.
Yes.
So as an example of this then, he uses sexuality as one of the key examples here. Now, the importance of this, because this can be misunderstood, this isn't necessarily saying that this is a more serious sin than any other. This for him is a key example because sexuality and spirituality were very much connected. Mm-hmm. And also because sexuality was tended to be associated closely with idolatry. Okay.
Yep.
So the one, you know, interesting in itself because, you know, because there's something so personal, so it's like that.
It's intimate.
Intimacy, you know, is a real soulful thing. It's not just a physical thing.
Yeah.
It is actually a kind of sacred union.
Yeah.
And so when we mess with that, we're messing with something about ourselves that is
way more than just the physical.
Way more than just the physical. It's a very sacred element of human life. And I think there's a whole topic in that isn't there?
Yeah.
This is something really sacred. So he's saying that's kind of been flipped. And so he picks up actually on a very typically Jewish idea here that the idea of turning away from the sort of natural course of things, you know, when Jewish people talked about the natural, it was in God's order, the way that God created things to be. And for Jewish thinkers and for Paul here, this is a way of, I guess, saying that it's kind of evident in nature what the right way sort of is. You know what I mean? That's sort of built into nature. And so, you know, he uses different kinds of deviation from that, from the essential biblical model of humanity. And this is a big theological picture that Paul is drawing on because humanity in Genesis 1 is understood as two halves of a whole, two complementary halves of a whole, where the male and the female joined, representing in a sense the unity of diversity in humanity, the ultimate example of diversity and oneness. Genesis chapter 2, you know, it's that you get very much the sense of two halves of a whole. It's often translated as Adam's rib, but actually in the Hebrew, you have a situation where it's almost like
one half.
Yeah, they're two halves of a whole. I mean, that's another topic. So Paul is drawing on a very rich idea of the way in which humanity reflects God. Is in the diversity, is in our being joined together as and particularly in the male-female relationship, the two halves of the whole. Now, this is why this example, particularly the example of same-sex relations, is used here. It's not because, this is the worst
sin.
of sins.
Yeah.
You know, lest we would point, as though our sexuality is all fine, but theirs is somehow it's all broken.
Yes.
That's part of the big point that he's making here. Yes. We're all broken in our different ways. This is an example that he uses of how when you turn away from God, everything gets kind of messed up, and that fundamental image bearing thing. Is the example that he uses.
Which is kind of the example that comes back to him saying God's shown us his glory throughout all of creation and then gone and saying how we've actually,
That's right. So the natural order, he's said that the natural order demonstrates something about God, but human beings have messed with that natural order. Yeah. And the point is then God has given them over to that. Mm. And so I think... this is often there are interpreters have come to this, I guess, in an effort to somehow want to show that Paul isn't saying that homosexuality is problematic. That, you know, it's been interpreted as maybe this is pederasty, which was quite a common practice in the ancient world. Pederasty is older men having sex with younger boys. Talk about that stuff, but that was actually very common in the ancient world. You know, is he talking about that? Maybe he's just talking about that. Maybe he's talking about non-committed. Is he talking about the wrong sort of approach to those? It's very difficult to get away when you look at the big picture of Paul that he actually is just fundamentally talking about same-sex relationships. Mm. It's really clear in the text. You have to do sort of exegetical gymnastics to get over that.
Yeah.
Now, of course...
And he moves on, Matt, to sort of say there's all these other things as well. It's not just that, you know, they are filled with, you know, unrighteousness, evil, greed, wickedness, envy, murder, disputes, deceit, malice, gossips. You know, it's not just about that.
That's right. It's not isolated. And I think this is the problem with the discussion around this particular issue, is that... the whole point here is that we are all in the same boat, right? Yep. And this is just one example. So for someone to point the finger, you know, at another, and look, for all of us working through our fallen humanity is a long and complex process, right?
Mm.
So I think, you know, like one of the most... sort of lamented sins in the Bible is the sin of pride. I mean, it's you know, pride is like much more sort of fundamentally demonic even than any sort of form of sexual sin.
Yep.
Now, you know, I could, you know, this is just something that I'm going to be for the rest of my life, I'm going to be struggling, you know, with this thing, you know, but so it's not as simple as just don't do it or just don't, you know. We're in a sense, part of the realism that Paul is introducing us to here is that there are these issues and we all are struggling with these issues, right? And we never really get our head above water, okay? We're always, you know, we're always going to fall short of
we're
the glory of God.
We're never going to be able to, exactly.
That's right. We're all constantly falling short of God. I can't just say, oh, you know, Lord, can you just take away my pride?
Hmm.
It's like... No, actually, the battle with that is actually the very battle itself. In fact, Stu, is part of the journey with God. You know, it's like there are. This is a life in which I have to actually sacrifice something of what I want for God. You know what I mean?
Yep,
it's
absolutely.
Like, you know, almost the more prone I am to a certain, you know, let's say to pride or you know, whatever
it may be,
that sin is, the more I have to sacrifice that, well, the more, in a sense, the more I have to give to God.
Yes.
It's like, you know, so, but the point being here is that we're all, you know, and this, I guess, is where what he goes on to say in chapter 2, to really emphasize, he sort of puts up a, you know, a kind of, he imagines...
A human example.
Yeah, a human example, because he says, you therefore have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else.
Yeah.
And I think he's, you know, he's either, he's thinking of a very moralistic person, and, and look, he's probably thinking of, you know, perhaps attitude that were held by perhaps some of the Jewish Christians, you know, well, we've got the law. And
we're following the
rules and they're not. Yep. But he could equally be thinking of a moralistic Greek like Seneca, you know, equally. So he says here, you therefore have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else, for at whatever point you judge another, you are condemning yourself because you who pass judgment do the same things. Yeah. We're all in the same boat here, so don't be pointing the finger at someone else. So, so what he does in this chapter, and there's a lot in this chapter, I think, that perhaps disturbs people, because Paul goes on to say things like, verse 6, God will repay each person according to what they have done.
Yeah.
To those who by persistence in doing good seek glory and honor, immortality, he will give eternal life. But for those who are self-seeking and who reject the truth and follow evil, there will be wrath and anger. There will be trouble and distress for every human being who does evil, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. But glory and honor and peace for everyone who does good. So this is the relevance of what I said about the view amongst Jewish people at the time that said, well, we're right because... we've been elected of God.
Yes, sign, sealed, delivered.
We're circumcised, circumcised Jews, sign, sealed, delivered. That's, you know, and we have the intention. Paul says, well, no, that doesn't make you right. Because this is the standard. The standard is we will all be judged according to what we have done.
Okay? Yes.
According, you know, there will be glory, honor, and peace for everyone who does good. So a lot of people say, oh, hang on. So is Paul...
It's works-based.
Yeah, is Paul saying that it is works-based after all. Mm. Well, no, we're all, in one sense, we're all in the same boat because we've failed to do these good works.
Yes.
But then what is this good thing? What is the good that we're called to?
Mm.
Well, it's the life of faith.
That's right.
And faith means...
produces good works.
That's right. Faith is... because he, remember, I pointed out in chapter one how he introduces the letter by saying, calling the Gentiles to the obedience of faith.
Yes.
He talks later on about that we, in a sense, fulfill the law by living by the Spirit, he will say later on. So faith, in a sense, is not opposed to good works. Mm. You could simply say faith works.
Yes.
Faith is a kind of life in which we actually fulfill, as we live by the Spirit, we actually fulfill what all of the law was pointing to in the first place. Now,
so good works doesn't lead to faith, but faith
leads to good works. Good way of summarizing it. Now, the question is, so are we then judged on how well we went?
Right.
That's the question. Yeah. Yes. So, because I think we're all too aware that,
well,
our faith is, is imperfect and, and we, you know, we don't live perfect lives. But see, that's where faith comes back in again.
Mm.
Because if faith is the most important thing, so faith is produces, gets us into this life in the Spirit that fulfills the law. But when we fail, faith then jumps in again and trusts in Jesus Christ to cover our failings. And God says that's actually the faith in that circumstance, that you would trust me to forgive you in Jesus' name. That's that actually is more important than you not having done things wrong in the first place.
That's right.
So it's not works against faith. It's not like, oh, God accepts faith as a sort of substitute, a cheap, oh, well, you couldn't live up to the law, so just believe instead. No, actually, God still wants us to live this life that he always envisaged. He wants us to be holy. This is all through this letter.
Yeah.
He wants us to be a light to the world. He wants us to live upright lives. He wants us to live by the Spirit and what not by the flesh.
What we were created to do.
Yeah, it's all through this letter.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
But that begins with faith. Right?
Yep.
It's and when we fail, God says, get up and step back onto the path. That's faith. So as long he's saying, what I want you to step up into this life in the Spirit in faith.
Mm.
Stay there by faith, and when you fall, make sure by faith you just step
back up into it.
And in every circumstance, it's the faith that's the main thing.
That's great.
Yeah,
really good.
So that, in a sense, actually, Stu, that sort of summarizes the really where we get to in chapter 3. But let me just close off.
Yeah, great.
His we're all in the same boat argument.
Yeah, great.
And I really want to underscore that this is his argument for unity. It's a classic, because I think sometimes we think, well, unity means that we've all got to agree on the same, or that we've all got to, no, we're actually all unified because we're all as bad as each other.
Yeah,
it's a really powerful sort of, I think there's a really powerful motivation for unity right there.
Yes.
Right? Because if you and I disagree over something and, we can't, and we fragment because of that. I mean, it's because somehow one of us thinks we're right, or we both think we're right.
Pride, whatever it might be.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. So it's because of our brokenness that we find ourselves.
But what if we just both agree that, yes, one of us may be perhaps more right in that sense, but what if in a much more fundamental sense we're both equally wrong?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, there's something to unite. There's something to unite us, because that then points us to a higher unity in Christ. So he's going to say... And look, throughout this first part, he addresses Jewish objections, because the Jews are thinking, he makes the point that, he says in 2:25, circumcision has value if you observe the law, but if you break the law, you become as though you were not been you've not been circumcised.
Yeah.
So he's, again, remember, he's arguing against that idea that, well, I'm a circumcised Jew, so that just, I'm saved.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my status. Well, he says no, because when you break the law, that's kind of annulled. So what you need is faith, actually, because it's only by faith in God's grace that makes you right. Because, you know, just being circumcised means nothing, actually, if you're not fulfilling the law.
And even to the Jewish people, he's kind of making the point also, in a sense, if you want to point the finger at others, and he's not actually saying this, but he's pointing out, you had the law. You should know better than the ones who didn't have the law.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the other Gentiles who didn't even have the Torah or the law.
That's right. So he's saying, in a way, you're even more accountable. Guilty. You are actually more accountable. Exactly. So don't be pointing the finger at other people. And the objection, of course, from the Jewish people, and he voices this because he's really thinking, you know, he can think like a Jewish, Jewish thinker, of course, Paul, because he was a Pharisee and he was very much right in the middle of this way of thinking. So he voices the objection, what advantage then is there in being a Jew?
Yeah.
That you can tell what they're thinking. Mm. Well, he says, well, because you were sort of the channel through which God
has come.
Entrusted the law and the prophets, right? That was, you were the vessel for that. Mm. It doesn't give you some special status or, you know, your Jewishness isn't the thing in itself that saves you.
In fact, it's greater responsibility.
That's right. That makes you more responsible. Mm. So he finishes, he says, what shall we conclude then? Do we have any advantage? He's talking about us as Jews.
Yes.
Not at all. If we have already made the charge, Jews and Gentiles alike, all under the power of sin. Mm. There is no one righteous, not even one. And then he goes down in, we're in 3, verse 20 now. Mm. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in God's sight by works of the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of our sin. So the law then points us to the problem, and it points us, therefore, to God's solution, that we need to trust in that solution.
Yeah.
So this is where we get this crucial passage in 3:21. Mm. He says, but now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been made known. Okay. So, in other words, there is a way of being made right with God that doesn't depend on how well we keep the law. Okay. So, but now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been made known. So, remember the righteousness of God? God is going to make things right.
Yes. Okay?
And it's not just by giving you the law and saying, well, live up to that. And if you live up to that, you're right. No, the righteousness of God has been made known. To which actually the law and the prophets testify. Mm-hmm. This righteousness of God, the way that God was going to make things right, was always the intention in the law. The law was never meant as a way for you to be perfect before God. God always knew. And in fact, you know, that was built into the law, because in the center of the law of Moses, of course, you get the moral law, but the center of it actually was the temple and the sacrifices.
Yes.
All of which pointed to God's way of salvation.
Correct.
That he's going to talk about right now.
Yep.
Okay. And so this righteousness is given through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. Okay. There is no difference between Jew and Gentile. Mm. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And this is, so that's the first unifying thing.
Yep.
Here's the second unifying thing. And all are justified freely by his grace. Grace means you didn't deserve it, but God's going to give you. This is the gift.
The gift.
By his grace through the redemption that came by Jesus Christ. Now, this is where he points to the bit where it was always in the law. This was always in the law. And he's going to allude to the temple sacrifices here in verse 25 of chapter 3. God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement. Now, that's a language that the Jewish people understood very well, because that's the sacrifices. That's you taking a sacrifice. That sacrifice is in a sense your substitute, stands in for you.
It's the blood offering.
That's right.
That is basically.
So it dies, in a sense, symbolically in your place. And so what Paul is saying, that's what Jesus did. So God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement. Mm. Atonement is this idea of making things right, okay? Of satisfying God's justice, in a sense, that's what atonement is. through the shedding of blood, again, that's alluding to the temple sacrifices, to be received by faith.
Yes.
See, that's the way it always was in the temple.
Yeah.
They would bring their animal and they would place their hands on its head. Their sin would be transferred to the animal would die on their behalf.
Mm.
And they would consider that my sin has been atoned for. Yeah. Now, he's saying, if you exercise that, you've already been exercising that faith. Well, we as Jewish people have already,
yes.
You know, when we go to the temple and they would probably in Rome, they'd probably go maybe once a year, once every now and again, and they'd take their sacrifice to the temple and they would trust
that
for that. Yeah,
that's
the, you know, so if you were willing to trust the blood of animal, how much more would you trust Christ for that? Okay.
Yes.
So he's drawing on very familiar ideas to them. So he says, he goes on and he says, he did this to demonstrate his righteousness. Okay.
Yeah.
Because in his forbearance, he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. He did it to demonstrate his righteousness at the present time so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus Christ. So here's the thing. God doesn't just let us off.
Well, that wouldn't,
a lot of, you know,
that wouldn't be just.
That's right. Because a lot of people say, well, what, like, can't God just forgive?
Yeah.
Why the whole complicated Jesus coming and dying on a cross? Can't God forgive? Well, God is just.
Yes.
God is not observing some. No, he is perfect justice. Okay. Mm. So God, therefore, by virtue of his character, will always do what is just. And that means that each person must reap what they sow. Where there is sin, there must be death. So, yet the sins committed before, all of those, you know, all of the sins of God's people through history, that the temple sacrifice didn't really take away. They pointed to the real solution, which was Jesus.
Yeah.
All of that remain kind of undealt with, right? So God shows his righteousness, his justice here, that he didn't, he forgave, and it was well known that he, you know, forgiven all of these people in the past.
Yes.
Yeah, but something's like, how is justice has got to be done? So God came to us in Jesus Christ,
yep.
Suffered and died, and came to be a sacrifice of atonement.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is the perfect demonstration of the justice of God as well as the love of God.
Yes.
Both of those things.
Yeah.
It's a stunning kind of moment. So righteousness has been fulfilled so that. And what we need to do in the same way as with the temple sacrifice, we need to trust in that.
Mm-hmm.
So now this is going to, in a sense, cleanse our conscience. This is, you know, in a sense, going to cleanse the temple of our hearts so the Holy Spirit can pour in and lead us to actually live the lives that we're meant to live. But it's always going to be imperfect.
Yes. Yeah.
And we still have, in the same way as the Jewish people, had the temple in the middle, you know,
yes.
of their existence,
yep.
We are centered around Christ.
Yeah.
So when we stumble, when we fall, he says, listen, the main thing, what's the main thing here? Faith in Jesus Christ is the main thing.
Yep.
That's what makes you right.
Mm-hmm.
That's how God, and again, coming back to this idea of the righteousness of God, God is the one who makes things right. He's done it in Jesus Christ.
Mm.
Trust him for that.
Mm.
If you fall off the path, exercise faith and step back up onto it and keep going.
Yeah. So when you say faith in Jesus Christ, what you mean is faith that Jesus has paid the price for you?
Well, it's a couple of things.
Yep.
It's let's talk about belief and trust.
Yeah.
They're more familiar
yep.
ideas. Interesting thing is we have three different words in the English that kind of overlap: belief, trust, and faith.
Right.
All of those words are used in English translations of the Greek New Testament, but in all of those cases, the Greek word is the same.
Right.
Okay. Pisteo is the Greek word.
Right.
And it's, depending on how it's used, we translate one of those three words. So pisteo is faith, trust, or belief.
Right.
And the best way to explain it is to say, use faith as the big idea involving belief and trust. So we believe that God has done so. We believe.
Yes.
There's the believe that,
mm-hmm.
but we also trust in.
Right.
You know, so we entrust ourselves. Faith involves not only believing that God is true to his word. That's a big and important idea in the Bible. Take God at his word. God has said, believe what God has said, but trust. Live in that belief. This is calling us, when we fallen as fallen people, believe that.
Yes.
In order that you can trust in and entrust yourself to.
Yeah.
That's
great.
Because, you know, if we think we're just condemned and, oh yeah, God's probably just rejected, there's no motivation there to entrust ourselves to a life in the Spirit. We'll just give up.
Yes.
It just leads to despair.
Yeah.
What gives us courage and what motivates us to live this life is God's grace. Like, God has actually restored me to this place. I'm gonna live this out. Which is a gift.
Given.
Absolutely. And this is a big theme throughout this chapter, is that God is offering us a gift. God has made things right. It's a gift. We receive it. We receive the gift by faith. Now, receiving a gift means receiving it as a gift.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't receive it like it's something we earned.
Yes.
And Paul's going to make a big, this is where he goes from here.
Mm-hmm.
He's really going to point out that God wants you to receive his gift as a gift.
Mm-hmm.
And a gift means that you didn't earn it.
Yes.
And so a big part of faith is recognizing you haven't earned it, but you don't need to, because Jesus has earned it for you. So receive that, receive the gift. Part of that gift, though, is not only the gift of forgiveness, but the gift of a new life in the Spirit. Now, here's the new life. Now go and live it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.